Hey everyone, and welcome to Don't Skip. I'm your host, Zach Seckler, and on today's episode, I chat with legendary creative Craig Allen. Craig spent nearly a decade at Wieden Kennedy, where he won armloads of awards, including two Grand Prix Lions at Cannes, Best in Show at the One Show, and a Grand Effie. His Old Spice campaign, Smell Like a Man, Man, has been lauded as one of the top ad campaigns of the 21st century. Craig co-founded his eponymous agency, Callen, in 2017, where he and his team have created celebrated work for brands including Clif Bar, Vistaprint, and Liquid Death. Now, it's been almost a year since I posted our last episode. My hope was for this interview to be the first in a new season of Don't Skip, but as it turns out, the extra time I had to create this podcast during COVID has just completely evaporated. So before any more time slips away, I really want to get this interview out there. It's a great one. Craig and I chat about his time at Wieden and how his insanely successful Old Spice work impacted his career early on. We talk about the challenges and opportunities of starting your own agency, and we talk about commercial directing and how Craig has actually directed a bunch of spots himself and almost ended up leaving agency life to become a commercial director. Check out thisiscallen.com to see some of the campaigns we talk through. And before we get going, a quick plug for the one and only sponsor of this show, me, Zach Seckler. If you're into visual comedy and you work in advertising, there's a good chance you'll like my directing and photography work. It's been a busy year, and there are a ton of new broadcast spots and print campaigns up on my website. You can check out that work at zachseckler.com. And now, without further ado, this is Don't Skip, Craig Allen. Craig Allen, good to see you again.
Likewise.
Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Where are you calling out of today?
I am a lone survivor in the Callen offices, which has been closed for, I think, 15 years now, ever since COVID started.
Yeah, well put. Where exactly are you guys located?
We're in Austin, Texas.
Nice.
Which is sunny and beautiful today, as per the usual.
That's the branding of Austin coming to life.
Yeah, this city is on fire, I think, these days. Everybody seems to be coming here, which is, I think it's great, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's good you already have your office. You already got the lease set up, right? Because it has been a big influx of particularly like creative, like agencies have been starting up and there's been just a lot of movement to Austin and the tech space. And
absolutely.
So good you're already established there.
Yeah, good point. Yes, we're glad.
Well, listen, there's so much. I usually talk a lot of biographical, like early start stuff, but because we already have talked about that in another medium, I want to kind of just jump right into it, into the work that's, you know, more later in your career. And, you know, one of the most well-known campaigns probably in advertising history is the Old Spice's Smells Like a Man, Man campaign. And I just want to kick it off with this question, which is, you know, I think many creatives dream of having a campaign that's even a fraction with the visibility and influence that has had on culture and in the marketplace. How did that spot shape your career?
All of the above answer. I mean, I feel like it, you know, look, I'm forever grateful for that spot. It did a couple of things. One of which is that it propelled Eric and I into management roles, which was great. You know, I'm not sure that we would have gone as fast into those just because I'm not sure that was something we wanted at the time. So it propelled us forward in our careers, obviously. And to be honest, I stayed on Old Spice becoming the CD at that time. And it allowed us to make so much great Old Spice work, which I'm as proud of as the stuff we did after that with Terry Crews and Professor Mr. Wolf Dog and all of the Rocket Car stuff, all of these things. It allowed us to have like such a good relationship with the clients and make so much work after that I think is part of the reason. I mean, it's the main reason that we're talking here today from the Callen offices, even though no one else is here because of COVID.
Mm-hmm. And that was my follow-up is, would you be in the same place in your career or just generally with Callen? Would you be in the same place without that one spot?
I'd like to say yes, but probably not. Yeah, no, I think it's you got to give credit where credit is due, and credit is due with Isaiah Mustafa and Old Spice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you as well. And Tom Kuntz, right? Who,
oh, yeah,
who directed. So it really did open the floodgates to create all of that amazing Old Spice work that followed.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, when you have something like that and you have so much success, it's everybody starts trusting a little bit more. There's gates, especially non-traditionally, that opened up after that. You know, we'd been trying to sell a different type of work. And it was, I mean, this is years and years ago. There was some resistance to that. And I think after you have some success, people are like, hey, let's give it a shot. You know, people are more willing to take more chances mm-hmm. when you have something that you can point to as successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, it's funny talking about all the Old Spice work that followed. We recently had Matt Sorrell on the show, who was involved in a lot of that Old Spice work. So
absolutely,
we talked in depth about that. So
yeah.
So fast forwarding a little bit. So that was, you know, that was when you were at Wyden and you started Callen, your agency, in 2017. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it was a little bit squirrely, but it was around the end of 2017.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what the process was for creating Callen? And, mm-hmm. you know, it's currently still affiliated with Wyden. Can you talk a little bit about that process, what it was like speaking with your team at Wyden and your vision for the agency and how it developed?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it was a weird time because I was in the best job at the best agency in the world. And I still felt myself, I mean, it was 15 years in. A lot of my partners had moved on to jobs, which I didn't pursue for a variety of reasons. And I was kind of just sitting there being like, how can I get myself excited to keep working? And I think a lot of it was just pure being bored with advertising. And I truly believe that you have to be bored with something, do something and do it so much that you become bored with it before you can even start to change something and make it better. And I think that's kind of where I was. And I thought that there was maybe a better way of doing things, not better, but just different, and something that I wanted to try. So I pitched that to Wyden as we were trying to figure out a way that we could keep working together. My wife desperately wanted to move back to Austin. And, you know, now everybody works remotely from everywhere, but there it was kind of rare. So I pitched the idea of starting something new. And I think, you know, it started off as I think we talked about it in the first time we spoke, is it was going to be more of a production studio, really. I was already in the DGA. I had directed a ton of stuff for Old Spice, the Fabio Isaiah stuff, the Isaiah response videos. We did basically Mr. Wolf Dog. We did a bunch of stuff that I directed and I liked doing it, but I never pushed myself into direction. It was more like when we couldn't afford a big time director, mm-hmm. we would be like, we can just do this ourselves. And then a lot of times it went quicker. So I toyed with like, should I go be a director? I talked with a bunch of production companies about maybe doing that. And I was just trying to find something that would make advertising exciting again. So I pitched that to Wyden and they agreed with it, which was awesome. Got to talk with Dan Wyden and Dave Luer and Colleen and get to know them a lot better. And they believed in it. And I love them to death for believing in what this could become. And then I think we came here and over time, we moved a little bit away from the production thing. We still try to make a lot of stuff ourselves, whether that be even Ranch Rider or directing stuff now. But moving a little bit more now into what we're calling like a lab more than an agency. And the idea being, how can we make more stuff for ourselves and experiment more and try to find clients that are more excited about collaboration through experimentation than just banner ads, for instance. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. that was kind of why we started Callen, is can we be experimenting more? Can I be closer to the work? Because that was another thing in advertising, in every industry, you get promoted out of the jobs you're great at. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't quite ready to be retired. I still think of myself as a young chicken, and probably since this is radio, I just imagine me super young and not old like I am now. But I think that I wanted to be closer to the work. I love making work. When I'm most happy is making stuff, you know, and I think all creatives are that. It's not the series of meetings that lead to the spot. It's when you get on the shoot, you know?
Right, right.
And so I'm trying to be on the shoot more often if possible. So that's why Callen exists. Make more good stuff for the world.
Uh-huh. I want to further on that and the what you mentioned about the creative lab part of it. But first, I want to just rewind a little bit and talk about your thoughts about becoming a director. You know, as a director myself, I find that Very interesting. Actually, that must have slipped my memory from when we first spoke, or it didn't make it into that initial cut. Can you tell me a little bit more about, you know, what that process, like the nitty-gritty, like you actually went to production companies and you had a reel, and like how serious were you and how far did it get?
Pretty far. I mean, I got into some serious conversations with some great production companies, and, you know, it was coming after all the Old Spice work, and then I had Old Spice work on my reel. So they thought it could be quite commercially successful. Mm-hmm. But I got to the point where I was like, I'm not sure that I would love directing other people's stuff as much as I like directing my own. Sometimes that can be a bit of a nightmare because I am so visual coming from I have a studio art degree, coming from an art background. The way I write is I see everything in my head and how it plays out. And then I just write what I think should happen. So a lot of times it's finding a director that I can collaborate with and letting go to some extent, knowing that they're better at crafting things than I would be myself. But yeah, I really enjoy creating things. Like I said, I kind of see it, so I know how it goes. And I just didn't know if I would enjoy getting scripts and having other opinions that I have to listen to and play the games. I liked it more when it was just more, I can go out and make something that I can already see in my head.
Right. Interesting.
That's what led me away from it. It's a different job, right? It's like, yeah, you have to, they're saying, here's our script. You write a treatment. They can come back and be like, no, incorrect. Your thoughts are stupid. We want to go this way. Or they just go with a different director. And I wasn't sure if I would enjoy that part of it as much as you need to be a director.
Right, right. That's really interesting. So it's the full ownership of the creative process that really, really spoke to you, that spoke to you the most.
Yeah. 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 And again, like, you know, in my head, it was like being a director is great because you don't have to do as many meetings and you can just get straight to the making, but there's just as many meetings. They're just with different people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I want to dig more into the directing part, but let's continue on with talking about talent a little bit more. So on your website's about page, I'm quoting, it says, Callan is an entrepreneurial creative lab with the belief that creativity has the power to change behaviors and shape the world in the most positive ways. We work for culture, creating things that find their own audiences, making things with their own value rather than just ad-like objects. I love that. I love that description. It's a beautiful way of describing what I think, you know, the best advertising is and can be. How difficult is it to lead clients to this way of thinking?
It can be difficult. And luckily for us, we get to choose now who we work with. So we try to stay as true to that as we can. And sometimes it leads to work and sometimes they go a different direction, but that's okay. You know, and I think for us, it's like we try to break as many advertising rules as possible, except for one, which is if you're going to put something into the world, it better be worth somebody's time to watch. You know, like I'm not a big fan of, we have a lot of money, so you have to watch this before you go on YouTube and watch a video you actually want to watch. Like,
right.
That's the only rule that I try to have all of us live up to, which is ask yourself before you present this, why in the world would I want to watch this? Or why in the world would I want to experience this stunt or whatever it may be? And if you don't have a good answer for that, then we should not present it. Because a lot of times we forget that.
I think it's the most important thing. That's why I named this podcast Don't Skip, is because it's about,
it's easy to skip, right?
Ads that you should, what, like that should provide value that, you know, right, you don't want to skip for that very reason. So let's talk about the, you know, the progression of Callan. It's now 4 years old. The last time we spoke, it was half that age. It was 2 years old. I feel like an uncle being like, you've grown so big. How has the agency changed and grown during the last 2 years?
Oh man, so many different ways. I mean, obviously we've gotten bigger. We're hiring now. We just hired some people as well that are coming in. But I think the biggest change since we last talked is we've become much more interested in finding ways to work for ourselves. And we try to exist on that no good ideas die. Like if it's a great idea, we have to figure out how to make it happen. If we can't find the right client for it, then we need to be able to make that for ourselves. So for instance, we did, and I don't know if you saw it, but there was a company called Our Littlest Ones. And that was, we're all parents, at least the me and my two partners, David and Juliana. And we couldn't find any masks that would fit our kids' faces in the beginning of quarantine. And we were like, well, that sucks. They're all adult masks. You have to twist around a bunch of times. And then the kids think they're in the hospital and it's scary and all that good stuff. So we set out to make these masks that kids would want to wear that were designed with designs that kids wouldn't be embarrassed to wear. So We made those. We learned a lot about manufacturing and production in the process. Then we recently, for vaccination cards, made a line of shirts and clothing called Immunity Market that actually have plastic holders where you can put your vaccination cards in the front of. And the idea was making vaccinations fashionable or having a way to brag that you're vaccinated.
Uh-huh.
And again, we've been doing more stuff like that and figuring out how to make more ideas and put them in the world, but find ways that we can work for ourselves and make profit off of our own projects as well has become a bigger thing for us since the last time we spoke.
Interesting. So you're talking about actually creating products, goods or services, and selling those through advertising.
Right.
So tell me, like, do you see that as, you know, you mentioned two things. I don't know how big they are, how big they got. Are they, do they have an impact on your bottom line or your ability to, you know, keep the doors open?
Yeah. I mean, I think they helped, you know, we never really did them. The idea was, especially in the masks, especially, you know, COVID went away, right? At some point. Oh, wait, no, it didn't. It's still around apparently. But we made enough masks that we donated some to a local children's hospital here, which was always the goal. And we learned a lot through that, where there's very strict rules about, you know, we wanted to do a buy one, get one, or a buy one and we'll donate this or whatever. There's very strict rules about that mm-hmm. we learned through the process. So we ended up just having to gift them and not talk about the fact that we gave them away.
Gotcha.
But it definitely was profitable, but it was never something where we haven't figured it out yet. I think the most times it's a full-time job and we have a full-time job. So we're trying to balance and figure out what's the right percentage of doing that as opposed to our other partners and clients.
Right, right. And it's a little tricky and probably not the best, not the main goal of creating something around COVID to profit off of it. But I guess what I was wondering about out loud is, do you see the idea of actually creating products and selling those products as part of the organization as being, is that being a bigger part of your strategy moving forward?
Yeah, 100%. I think, you know, in my dream scenario is that we're not just making stuff, but I love the idea of one day having collaborations where you're on equal footing with who you're collaborating with, as opposed to just trying to get Callan mentioned in a line of a PR article, like blank plus Callan or blank times Callan or whatever, and yeah. What we could do together to create something great. That would be the goal. It's like pure collaborations as opposed to paid collaborations.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think all those things, every time we do one of these, I think it makes us better advertisers because we're learning so much that I didn't know that I needed to know about distribution, advertising, just ins and outs of the kind of the dirty part of advertising as far as creative is concerned. And now when we interact with clients, I kind of have more empathy than I ever did, where I understand where you're coming from. And it used to be like, how dare this feedback? Like, I just don't understand how they could say these things about my beautiful baby that I've birthed on the paper. And now I'm like, I kind of understand where they're coming from. Yeah. And it's made the work stronger and it's made the relationship stronger because I don't have to be like, I don't get it. This is wrong. I can be like, I kind of understand where you're coming from. And I think I know how to fix it because I've had to deal with this same kind of crap myself on our own companies. Mm-hmm. So I think that's been really helpful.
Can you give a specific example of something that's changed your perspective, what you're just talking about? Like when a client comes to you with a problem and now you can say, oh, I can relate to this because we experienced this.
Yeah, I think in the past, like we'd have great, mostly on the non-traditional front, or even just distribution and cost of product has been a very big eye opener. When we made those masks, what we did is we made them a little bit too nice. Like we were like, well, parents are going to care. They're going to want the best materials made in the USA with extra filtration and all these things. And we made masks that were, it was hard to turn a profit on them. We barely made any profit on them, which mm-hmm. we ended up probably donating to the children's hospital. But it was kind of an eye opener where like people didn't really care about that. And we made masks that were too high quality for what people wanted, you know? So I think when we go, when I talk with clients and I see how their advertising budgets work and how what their overhead and what they're getting back on their investment on the products, I think has been super helpful and eye-opening as opposed to that. So when I go and I say, hey, we should do this crazy idea, this stunt or this activation, and they're looking at it from cents and dollars, I kind of understand, oh, that doesn't really make sense because that's going to make this cost so much money that we're not even turning a profit on what we're selling or whatever mm-hmm. it may be.
Would an ultimate goal or dream be to have a big brand that you could fully control the advertising on? So you'd have full, we were talking about ownership, and in this case, talking about actually creating products and selling them and creating the advertising for them, you would have full control and ownership over the entire process. Would that kind of be a dream of yours?
It would be a dream.
In addition to keeping your existing clients in and working as an agency, as a creative lab, as we talked about. But
it would be a dream. I mean, and I think that's, but it, going even all the way back to the directing thing, bringing everything, tying it together, it's like, I feel like I want to own every part of the process. But when you work with somebody like a Tom Koontz or a Steve Rogers or an Ulf or these directors that bring something new that you couldn't have possibly seen, you realize, oh, they're better at these things than I am, and we're making each other better together. And I think that one thing I've learned in making of companies is we shouldn't try to be a ketchup company, for instance, because I don't know how to make ketchup, and I don't know how to distribute ketchup, and I don't have the relationships to put those in stores. So I think what we're learning is, if you would ask me this even 6 months, a year ago, I would have been like, that's the dream. We want to make a ketchup company. We're going to do the whole thing, soup to nuts. And now I'm like, no, we want to find companies that can handle that part of it, that are experts at making things. And then we work together to build a brand. And so a lot of that, you know, we're taking a lot of calls from startups now, and startups that have no money, but they're willing to let us come in, even sometimes we're their CMO, you know, and making, helping make decisions that are completely shaping the companies. And to me, that's great, because we're all aligned. It's all building from a brand voice and a platform, and we're building these brands together. So whether it's our idea that we're finding people to collaborate with us that are pros at making whatever that thing is, or finding a startup where we can come in and be part of that company with them and financially be tied together, that's more the goal now than saying we want to do everything soup to nuts, because it's just, it's a little bit naive, I've learned through the process.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. There's only so many, you wouldn't want to run a ketchup company and an auto tire company, and it just doesn't make sense, right?
So
So basically the idea is working with startups who have all of the expertise and the operational knowledge to run that company, and you guys having an ownership stake in the startup phase and realizing the gains of excellent advertising in the long run.
Yeah, it's like, know what you're good at and then find people that can help make your dreams a reality. That's like that's the goal of making a company, I feel like. And not trying to do, if you try to do everything, you will learn a lot of mistakes that you've made in the process.
Yeah. Talking about mistakes, let's talk about any mistakes that you guys have made at Callan.
Oh man. It's like a 5-hour podcast. I think it's been, for me, we're always trying to, you know, I come from Wieden and Kennedy background, walking in stupid, not being afraid to fail. And I've tried to bring a lot of that thinking here. So we've made a lot of mistakes along the way that have made us stronger and better, which I think if you're afraid to make mistakes, you end up making the same ads that everybody else is making, and then you're skipping all of them, right? So I think we've learned so much. A lot of it has been on that distribution front, and the fact that, you know, like I was just speaking about, that not trying to do everything ourselves, and learning where to be, supplement your dreams to make more work to put in the world, I think is the biggest thing. And it's just, yeah, like I said, making things too expensive because we don't understand the ins and out of production. It's also been hard trying to start companies in COVID when everything, there's a Velcro shortage. Did you know that? Like, I didn't. We needed Velcro for our shirts, and that became a problem. And then we needed plastic holders for the cards, which that was a delay because we couldn't get those. So it was like, all of these things that were like, well, in hindsight, we probably would have designed the shirts slightly different if we knew there was not going to be enough Velcro to go around.
Mm-hmm. And what about, you know, in 4 years now of running a small agency, what has maybe defied your expectations or has gone against what you thought it might be like when you were just starting it and dreaming about what it would be like? You know, how is it different than what you expected?
I think that I thought it would be a little bit easier, even though everyone, all the smart people I talked to coming in told me it wouldn't be. You know, I think it's one of those things where, like, even now I'm like, everybody says Everest is the worst and you could never climb it. But I'm like, I could probably do it if I really wanted to. Like, I could try it. And then I would end up as like that frozen person on the trail that people use as a mile away point, you know? So I think I kind of thought it would be, I heard from everybody, it would be hard. And it has been more challenging in different ways that I could have never expected. I kind of thought it would just kind of work out and be fun and a party the whole time. And it's been a little bit, it's been a party, but it's been a party that had a lot of setup and breakdown on the back ends of it, right? So
can you dig in on maybe one thing that's been really challenging that you weren't expecting?
Well, I think nobody loves pitching. I actually don't mind pitching because I fear the pitches where you don't get to show work, because a lot of times you end up with clients that you don't want to make the right kind of work. So I actually don't mind showing work in pitches. But I think I've been amazed to find out how little the pitch process has to do with work, unfortunately. It's a lot of like, it comes down to money. And a lot of times more just strategy than work. And then really what all that comes out of the world is the work. So I think, you know, for me, the pitch process has always been a little bit of a thing that I struggle with, because you never get to show as much work. You don't know enough to give insightful work. I like to try to make work that's grounded in human truths and actually will help them, but you're coming in a vacuum from outside. So I think that was the thing. I just kind of assumed that we, based on reputation or based on whatever it would be, that we'd have this kind of influx of people that are just ready to make game-changing work. And it's been a little bit more of a grind in that perspective.
Is the pitch process different? Or I'm sure it is. So maybe how is the pitch process different at Callan than it was at Wyden, or, you know, just more generally at, you know, at a big agency?
I think a couple of things, you know, I'm sure we covered it in our last talk, but the one thing that's unique about us, and this was a Dan Wyden request, because Wyden is set up the same way, we can never be sold. So unlike 99% of small agencies who are trying to build up to the point where they can then sell themselves for some big payoff, my payoff is just success along the way, because we can never sell. So I think how we pick businesses and the businesses we go after is completely unique. And it's clears up a lot of things, because I'm not like, some people would be like, well, I know this is going to be the worst, but if we just get this and we grind it out, then that will help us be sold quicker. I would never take that piece of business because that's not beneficial for me. So, And we're small on purpose, you know, so we're very protective of who we bring into the fold. We like to have a small team. I'm very involved. Everybody here is get their hands dirty all the time. So we grow slowly, and then we pitch. Even recently, we've won a bunch of pitches recently. We've been very fortunate to find super cool partners to collaborate with. And that's allowed us to take a step back and say, are these companies we really want to work with? And we've actually turned down a handful of pitches in the last month or so, just because, not because they weren't great opportunities, but we're also, we pick the people we have for a reason, and we want to be involved, and we promise that too. So we can't take new business if it's going to fault us being involved in the business we already have and love. So I think it's just an interesting way to pitch, because before it'd be like, man, this is a lot of money, we got to pitch it. We're like, ooh, this is a lot of money. We're going to have to hire like 40 people. Do we want 40 people here? Do we want to actually be doing this? And a lot of times the answer is no. And we gravitate more to these big companies that have a smaller footprint that we can kind of work with on a higher level.
Mm-hmm. And talking about having employees and hiring employees, what's the culture like at Callan? How have you crafted the culture, and how would you describe it?
It's a weird time to talk about culture, because of all the remote working.
Yes, that's right. As you're sitting in a cavernous open office with nobody else in it.
Only echoes. Yeah. I mean, we've been lucky in that we don't have so many people that when we get together, it violates some protocol laws. You know, it's like, If a big agency got together right now, you're not getting a gathering of 500 people to do an offsite. We're small enough that we've still been able to do offsites respectfully outside, you know, kind of fun things. And we talk a lot more. I miss being in an office. I love interacting with people. I think that's when the best work is made, when you can look at people, you can put stuff up on the wall, you can draw things. And a lot of that's lost with remote work, but I've also seen the value of remote work. So I think we try to make sure that everybody's having fun, that at least the work we're working on is fun, and that it's never taking itself too seriously, and us as people and us as process. So I'm anxious for us to get back in here, because I do miss the in-person culture of the whole thing, which I don't think is just unique to us, obviously. But we're trying to have a lot of fun on the way, and we're trying to really embrace COVID working, and as we come out of this, not just going back to normal, but we've had our best year this year that we've ever had, and being remote the entire time. So we tried to come back into the office for a little while, and then Delta started back up, and then we went back away. But we're much the fans of, we've seen, we're all self-sufficient. And when you like working, you don't have to constantly be checking in on people and worried if they're working or not. Everybody's gone above and beyond. We have such a great team here. So we're very open to, maybe we only come into the office 1 or 2 days a week and we regroup on everything and then we work separately. Maybe we, in the summer, we have a month where everybody is encouraged to work anywhere but Austin, you know? So I think we're very open to figuring out how to give people space, but also have enough coming together that you're making each other better. Because I do think that's where everybody's getting hurt right now. Even going all the way back to directors, and I keep bringing back directing because I know that you're a director and that's really, you're super interested in that. I hate the fact that I've done shoots this whole year where I didn't get to go to shoots. We still collaborate. The directors have been great that we've worked with, but you're missing something not being in the same room, writing stuff, drawing stuff, being like, hey, can we move this thing here? There's a lot of things remote. You're not going to be like, I have these small ideas that would make things 8% better, but then I have to like talk through the computer, to talk to the producer, to talk to the director. And it's just creating these walls between people. And when work is really special is when people get together. So I think that's the bummer of the whole thing about the culture in the office and just the working right now is we need to get together.
And it's also, and as you were just talking about with being, you know, trying to collaborate virtually on set, is that it takes time. It takes so much extra time to communicate, and time is so much money when you're on set, right? So it's like, you may not say, oh, let's just try this, or, you know, just the extra time that it would take, you might not, like the communication becomes a bottleneck, right?
Totally. And we're not on set. So there's little things that are happening on set where you can see maybe an actor is getting really annoyed or really tired or something. When we're watching a feed, you can't tell that. If we're on shoot, we'd be like, hey, let's not probe here because we can tell it's wearing them out or whatever. We don't have any of those cues. So I think it's same thing here with the culture. Again, we try to be as fun and loose and have as much fun as we can together. But it's hard to read people virtually. Like it's hard to get a read on how people are feeling, how their mental state is. Because a lot of times that doesn't have to do with just work. Like I'm not sure. We have people all over the country working for us right now. And I think they're all doing great. We get on, we laugh, we go do things virtually or have hangouts here in Austin and everybody has fun. But I can't see the day-to-day thing where I care a lot about who all the people we work with. And not just as employees, but as people. So if I can see somebody's down, if we're at work, I'd be like, hey, everything cool? Like, you want to talk about anything? It's hard to do that and keep tabs on people, which is a bummer.
Let's switch gears here a little bit and talk kind of broadly. I just, you know, you touched on it very briefly earlier about your visual sensibilities. How would you describe your sense of humor and your visual inspiration?
A little messed up. I feel like it's, you know, I think when I try to write scripts and when I'm, you know, working with teams and everything, I try to think of the way that there's always a way that spots are supposed to go, or ideas or stunts or whatever are supposed to go. And I take particular pleasure in seeing how it's supposed to go and then doing the exact opposite, you know, even to the point of keeping myself guessing to where I'm like, oh man, it would never do this. So it should do that. For instance, I'm on a horse. It was like, there is no reason why he should be on a horse at the end of the spot. Nobody would do that. So that's what we should do. So I try to keep that and I try to instill that in our creatives is try to think about this in your head, how it should go. And then just turn it 20% left or right until you're surprised where when you're telling me a script, I should be like, whoa, did not expect that. You know, it's kind of one rule I always have. And whether that be, it doesn't always just have to be humor. It can be even emotional spots as well, or powerful, visual, powerful spots. But I think the other thing I try to do is don't just be weird to be weird. Don't just kick people in the genitalia because it's funny every time. It's like grounded in human truths and things that people can relate to. So I've always tried to do humor based in something that's relatable, not just because it's funny. And I think that's where jokes become better, when you can let people in on the jokes, when you can ground it in something that I can relate to, that's not just a random joke for no reason. I try to do all of those things. So I think I try to be really dry. I try to have what I would consider like a smart humor as opposed to just, I have a 9-year-old son and there's a different type of joke I tell to him than I want to put into a commercial.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which isn't always the case if you watch TV. I think sometimes it's the same.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's I have a 9-year-old son as well. And,
oh, funny.
Yeah. Their sense of humor is, it's a little different.
Oh yeah.
It's definitely on the humor matrix, very lowbrow. It's some of the more smart comedy stuff doesn't quite go through, but I think I'm totally with you on, you know, I love what you said about, you know, just tweaking things 20%, and, you know, so much of humor is about creating unexpected moments and creating surprise, right? And having those moments tie back to something that's within the brand narrative or the narrative of the spot connects so much better and is more kind of polished and high quality, in my opinion, than just like, yeah, Homer getting hit with a football between the legs,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah, always a time and a place for Homer.
Even though it's a great gif.
Yeah, it's always good. But yeah, and I think that's when we have a client being like, wow, we just did not expect to go this way. And we know when we come to you guys, we're going to be challenged and we're going to end up with ultimately better things, but you're going to push us to new and better places and give us stuff that we can't find anywhere else. Those are like the biggest compliments you can get, you know? Mm-hmm.
Tell me about, I've been checking you out on Instagram, and I saw like recently I forgot exactly what I was about to pull up Instagram, but I don't want to be rude. I was looking at like one of your posts where you were like on a bus, like celebrating somebody's birthday, and you guys were all dressed up. And then Halloween, you had like done something really creative. I feel like are you just like a super, always like a really comedy focused person in your life outside of work?
Unfortunately, yes. As my wife says constantly, she's like, not everything has to be a joke. We were doing our Christmas cards last night, and it's something that I don't take part in because I'm so particular and she hates it. So I just let her do the Christmas cards that goes to everybody.
Right.
But she showed me and she typed up what the message was going to be on the back. And it was like generic, what I assume you can pick A, B, or C if you have no creativity at all and you put it on the card.
Yeah.
And I rewrote it. And she said last night, like, it doesn't always have to be a joke. And I'm like, but why not?
Oh, my
you know,
God.
It's like, I feel like I always operate. It's kind of a depressing, dark way to live, but I always assume that I might die tomorrow. So why not go do everything today? So yeah, that was my birthday. We dressed, we rented John Denver and Jacques Cousteau. They apparently had a joint tour bus in the 70s.
Uh-huh.
And we rented that. I shaved my facial hair into an embarrassing mustache and went to a boot city place here in town and bought a whole getup, and everybody dressed up as cowboys. And we went out because I was like, why not? You know, I don't know why I would do that otherwise.
I love it. I love it. It's funny. I've also, my wife has said the exact same thing to me of why would just everything have to be a joke? And I've said the same response. I feel like, why not? There is humor in everything. I truly believe that. I truly believe that. So let's dig into a couple of specific spots. Let's talk about Liquid Death, the vegan cannibal steakhouse spot, which is pretty new. Came out right before Halloween. Can you, first off, I'm going to link to this, but for people who haven't had a chance to watch it before this very moment, can you describe the spot to our listeners?
Yeah, the whole concept was, you know, Liquid Death, such great guys to collaborate with, Mike and Andy and all those guys. It's so nice to work with somebody that just kind of gets it. You don't have to explain the benefit of doing a stunt like this. They're just like, well, yeah, of course you do those because people need to care. And there's no media to rely on. I love media. It can be very helpful, but it's like if you completely rely on it, you know, you don't have a very good idea. And when it comes to Pabst, to PBR, who we've collaborated with a lot, or Liquid Death, there's no media, so you better have a pretty funny, engaging idea. And I think this one was, the brief was, how do you scare people on a Halloween? And the idea that you don't need to have ghosts and goblins. There's a lot of real scary stuff in the world that you could poke fun of. And they did it even last year before us with possessing water in their warehouse. It's like, it's kind of messed up. But it's like real. And so this year, the idea being, you know, there's cannibalism is a real scary thing that has happened in history and probably happens today, unfortunately. And then there's all the, you know, the movement around vegans and grass-fed and healthy living style. And we're like, what if the joke was, what if the cannibals, you went, you're a cannibal, but you no longer eat meat because of all that you care about the environment and global warming and everything, and you need a vegan option. So that was the idea. And how can you make a pop-up restaurant or whatever? You know, this was an idea. We shot it in the vein of a cheesy corporate commercial, you know, for a big chain restaurant where everything's happy and everybody's happy to be there and the family's all coming because you eat all your meals with your grandparents and your extended family, of course, in corporate land. But they're all cannibals. So it was a fun thing to shoot because you got to play up the cheesy factor. We went to a restaurant. We had to work with vegan chefs to figure out how you could make things that look like human flesh that were completely based off of plants, right? Mm-hmm. So that was something that I, working with people to be like, getting it as close to human flesh as possible, which is kind of messed up. But it, then you kept reminding you, even when we were shooting it, I don't know how many times I said, gross, as we were shooting. Cause I was like, in my head, I knew what we were doing, but then I had to be like, but it's all plants. So you're like, I guess it's fine. It looks disgusting. And I hate, and it's very scary, but it's just plants. So it's fine, right? We're just fine. It's fine. So that was, we did the whole spot, like if it, as if it was a, Olive Garden spot or
I was just gonna say it's basically like Olive Garden, like with this vegan cannibal meat stuff
children eating it with sauce,
like a 70s, maybe like a 70s Olive Garden, and it's got kind of definitely some overarching like Tim and Eric type of vibe.
Yeah,
like you could just see something ridiculous is about to happen. But instead of it being like absolutely disgusting, it's just this meat that we're, this like quote unquote meat that we're looking at, right?
And it's funny, the straighter we played it like a real commercial, because we didn't put any jokes in it. You know, it was like, we had some written and we kept throttling them back because it was like, it's funny just in and of itself. So you don't need to have a joke where somebody gets arrested or whatever it may be, because the more sincere you do it, we wanted people to be like, is this a real thing? And then you could actually order the food on Postmates, which was super cool. So, and then a lot of people did that. So that was fun too.
I think that was a great, I love that you didn't have anyone getting arrested or anything. You stay completely in that world and it's just so funny for what it is. I love that.
Yeah, it's more messed up when you play it real, as opposed to Homer taking the football in the crotch, you know?
Right, right.
The reoccurring theme.
And it ties back to what we were talking about earlier with, like, you know, not just putting in a joke for joke's sake, right?
Right.
So what was the initial brief and how the creative developed? Like, was there a big change from when the idea first came up and how the creative developed throughout production?
No, I mean, I feel like the script stayed pretty true to form, you know, and again, it's always nice when you're working with people that get it and the team over at Liquid Death collaborating with them. And we all knew what we were trying to accomplish, and it was a very easy shoot because it was like, of course, like this, you know, and I just pulled reference from old restaurant, corporate chain, you know, restaurant commercials. And we were like this. And everybody's like, well, yeah, of course. Yeah, that's it. So it was very easy, seamless process and not a lot changed. The only thing that changed was as we got into working with vegan chefs and making the dishes, we were like, ooh, we can't make this, but we can make this. Or like, how are we going to make bones sticking out of the rack of Sam? Which is one of the things. It was like grilled rack of Sam or guiltless rack of Sam,
right,
or something.
Right.
We had to make those out of, like, I believe it was celery or turnips or something. So it was a lot of experimentation on that side. But yeah, no, the script stayed pretty true.
And how did you come to direct this?
That was, again, talking to Mike and Andy and the crew. It was, we didn't have a gigantic budget because we were using the budget to make the food and make the Postmates thing and all that good stuff. And it does get to a point where directors are, at some point it falls off. And that's, for me, it's always like, if we can get somebody that I know will make it better, always do that before me. I would never just be like, I should do it. But at some point it falls off where it's like, you know what, this is going to be easier. I know exactly what it should be in my head. We got to do it super quick. I think we did it. Approval to shooting was like maybe a week, you know, like it happened very quick. Yeah. So it was kind of like, we didn't really have time for, or was needed for an outside opinion. It was kind of, we were all so aligned that we were like, let's just get together. They flew down and we just had a lot of fun smearing red sauce all over people and having them eat these vegan. We enjoyed it a lot more than them. I don't know if they liked them as much as they did in the commercial.
So you've directed several things, several spots. Mm-hmm. So you're a seasoned director, really. But, you know, as a director and like, is it weird to kind of be playing both roles where you're developing the creative or having a big part in developing the creative and also directing? Is it ever get like wonky, or do you feel like anything is ever lost in the process there?
Well, yes and no. I love it because it's very streamlined. It's like, you know, usually you have ideas and you have to throw them out, and then the director is there to be like, no, that's stupid, or yeah, that's cool. And it's easier to sell it through clients too, because they know I'm going to act in the best interest because I don't want to make more problems for myself on the backside of this. But I can also talk to them. They know we're on the same team. I'm like, I promise you this will be the good thing, right way to do this. And they're like, okay. And they trust me a little bit more than like an outside director. And I'm speaking even for Ranch Rider was a company here that it makes canned cocktails that I directed a bunch of spots for. And that was just a blast. It was, again, not super well-funded, but not peanuts either. Mm-hmm. And it was just, we cast here in Texas. We went out to a ranch and I just had so much fun like bringing those to life. And I got to work with editors and VFX places that there's not a lot of good work going around. So I said, hey, look, I know we don't have all of the money that we usually have, but you know, we'll hit you on the next one. Mm-hmm. Can you help us out on this one? And they're like, yeah, you have a guy who pulls off his mustache and he has a jalapeno stuck to his face. Like, we'll figure it out, you know?
Yeah.
So that was always fun. So, I mean, I say yes in that it's just super seamless and quick. Like the whole shoot, pre-pro, everything just goes super quick and efficient. The bad thing is that, you know, there is benefit if you get the right director. They always bring something to it and make it better that you would not have thought of. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's not that, right? You would like to think that maybe if we shot with somebody else, maybe they would have handled something different, which would have made it better. You know, that's the hope all the time.
Sure.
But for me, in that particular case, it was just a blast.
What's the process like? So is there a creative director who's on that account? Are they with you like they would be with an outside director? And are you kind of collaborating with them going back and forth? Or are you kind of just all on your own? How does it, what's it like when you're actually shooting?
Oh yeah. On that particular one, we had a creative, super senior, great creative team, Matt and Kyle. And it was just us three in a room writing the scripts together and then going out and shooting it on set. It was like being here at Callan in the room where we go and just throw ideas around and laugh until we're all laughing, except we were on set. So it's like, oh, let's try that or whatever it may be. It just felt like it was almost like a writer's room on set, as opposed to sometimes you're in a writer's room in client services area of the shoot on set. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was just, they were throwing out ideas. We would try anything and we were just kind of talking till we made each other laugh and on set.
So let's talk about your history of directing and how you started off early on, and maybe if you've gained or maintained skills as a director that you had absorbed through your early days working with some prolific talents like Tom Koontz and Steve Rogers and the list goes on of all the folks you've worked with. Are there any particular like lessons or specific things that you've brought into your directing process?
Yeah, I would like to think I'm like a melting pot of all the amazing directors that I've worked with in some capacity. I think I've been very fortunate to work with kind of the best directors in the world, in my opinion, you know, and taking a little bit, not trying to just, you never want to copy somebody and become a carbon copy of them, but taking a little bit here and a little bit there and combining it with you to make something completely new. Mm-hmm. I would say there's probably bits of every director I've ever worked with when I direct.
Can you give an example of like something specific, maybe one little bit that's part of you that came from somebody?
Yeah, I would say early on in my career, and I think any good director now, I'm a big, giant fan of doing things practically. All of the stuff we did in Ranch Rider was done practically. I shot the jalapeno. We had a mustache. We had rigs. We did the whole thing. I'm not a huge fan of CGI in the least. Not to say I don't use it occasionally, but I try to do things real. And that comes from early working with Tom Koontz and Ulf and a bunch of different people when I was just a baby creative. And, you know, something like Beard, Skittles Beard, for instance. We talked about like, should we do it with computers? And it would have been like Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, crazy tentacle thing all over. And Tom really pushed us to his credit. And even before I got on Skittles, the first round with Ulf, do things practically because beautiful things happen that you couldn't have expected. So I would say that's ingrained in me from the very beginning, where I was like, oh, okay, yeah, practical. That's a word that's used, you know, even to that point where I don't think I've ever thought about effects. And now effects is a big way of how I approach directing and writing. Like I can, a lot of times I feel like I'm, again, maybe the worst enemy sometimes directors, because I feel like I'm like, I wonder if we can make a rig that does this. Mm-hmm. And they're like, either they're like, hey, I'm the director, I'll figure it out. Or they're like, huh, or maybe it can do this, but that's an interesting way of handling that joke. You know, so I think even from the beginning, borrowing things from Tom and Ulf about shooting things practically, and even though it's more difficult, it's a better payoff in the end. I would say I've kept that forever, you know, mm-hmm. It's Sensibilities of Steve Rogers, for instance, another great friend and previous collaborator, is he has such a great sensibilities in the way he shoots and the way he's able to handle humor in such a sophisticated fashion, and just being confident in your jokes and letting them out there. And don't try to, what I call a joke parade, where you just like put a joke on top of a joke on top of a joke because you're not sure if it's going to be funny. Like, no, you write good jokes and you lean into them and you trust them.
So last time we spoke, I asked you about advice for directors. And you said one thing that you really recommended was against younger directors becoming like yes men, right? Of just wanting to please the client or please the agency, which I think is kind of an initial instinct that a lot of young directors kind of fall into, because, you know, they've gotten their first like big job and they don't want to screw it up. They don't want to hurt the relationship. So as a director who when you're a director and there's no one else that's like, that you're kind of going back and forth with and potentially like someone's challenging you, do you ever like challenge yourself in a different way? So you make sure that you're like holding yourself accountable as the director to making the best work possible?
You know, a lot of it has been clients that I have, even all the way back to Old Spice when I directed a lot of that stuff. And it was, I'd have to be accountable for those reasons. If it doesn't work out, you know, you can't just be if you're a director, you can be like, well, I thought it was the best. Good luck to you. I don't have to be on the calls all next week where they go, you have to be like, hey, I made a mistake. You know, they're like, yep, sorry about that. Good luck. So that's definitely affected, you know, how I approach things. And I think, you know, sometimes because I'm can be a bit heavy handed and because I'm a visual writer, if you will, I have to remind myself that like, it can be better than my own brain, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think it's like, even when we're on set, I'm like, no, but this is the way it's supposed to go. And somebody has an idea. I wouldn't say I'm like, I need to say yes so that I can stay in good favor, because that's the best part, is there's no one to stay in favor with. For better or worse, it's usually people that work for me. So they're giving me opinions. But if I don't have to be like, man, I just want to stay in good favor with them. But I also have to remind myself, like, these are funny people and talented people, and they might be better than your ideas. So I think a lot of times I have to just remind myself, because there is no checks and balances. There's a checks and balances with director. If you're the director and the creative director and sometimes the client all in one, I encourage those checks and balances, because I'll fly off the rails otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about one other spot. I think we have time to dig into one more. How about we chat about the Vista print, the fish spot with the flying fish?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Can you, first off, as you so graciously did with Liquid Death, can you describe the Vistaprint, the fish spot?
Sure. Yeah, that spot is for Vistaprint, and it's the idea that you can pivot very quickly using Vistaprint as a partner for small businesses when a problem arises, catastrophic in this state, problem arises. They have all these products for small business owners that they can pivot very quickly to change their business. So it's a woman who owns a burger restaurant. It's kind of right on the water. And then it suddenly is invaded by all these horrible flying invasive fish, and it kind of ruins everything. And usually that'd be catastrophic, but she's able to think for a second, collaborate and partner with Vistaprint to change her restaurant into a sushi restaurant through products and offering. And then that's how it resolves, is that she goes from a burger restaurant, fish are everywhere, opportunity, not disaster. Let's make it a sushi restaurant.
Love it. And there's so much practical visual comedy in this one. You can tell because fish are literally flying and hitting people in the face, landing on people's plates, you know, pushing the burger aside, and there's a huge fish on the plate instead. Can you talk about, you talked about the kind of, it seemed like the initial brief a little bit. What was the process of selling this idea through to the client?
It was a bigger campaign where we showed a bunch of different problems that a small business owner face that they could use Vistaprint to pivot to something new. And I think fish was probably the most crazy of the three versions. I mean, it's not like anything was safe. The other one was a hotel that was invaded by ghosts, and the other one was a yoga restaurant or yoga studio that an asteroid hit in the middle of, and then she just changes it to hot yoga and leaves the asteroid there. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, fish was a little bit harder to sell because it was just crazy. It was more like the Super Bowl version of the three spots, you know, and they liked it from the beginning, you know, and we just said how funny it's going to be. And we showed, there's a lot of videos online these days where people are just fishing and a fish jumps out and hits them in the face. So we were able to be like, see, this will be funny. It's not going to be gross. It's going to be hilarious. So we pulled some references and just talked them through it. And Vistaprint's great client. And they were like, yeah, let's do it. My favorite video from that shoot is, we weren't there. It was the height of COVID, you know, so we shot with Craig Gillespie, who's awesome. And somebody sent me a video from the shoot that is people in the restaurant, and then there's boats of people outside of the restaurant, and they're just grabbing these mechanical fish and just throwing them in the restaurant. And it's like, you can't even see the spot.
Yeah.
You're just seeing just to the side of the spot. And then this is one of those moments where you're like, what is my job?
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, and you hear somebody on megaphone being like, aim for their face, aim for their face. And I'm like, what a weird job we all have.
You mean this is the best job on earth is what you're thinking, right?
Yeah, I come home, I'm like, what a crazy day at work. I mean, we just had the fish weren't hitting the people like we were hoping. And my wife's like, what are you talking about?
Everything's a joke, honey. Okay, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah,
why does it always have to hit them in the face? Because that's funny.
I want to hear more about this. So you guys had mechanical fish, and then what was like, tell me more about the actual nitty gritty of how this was created with the fish effects. Was it all practical? I think there must have been one VFX shot where they're all jumping out of the water, like the wide shot. That must have been VFX, right?
It was a blend. You know, we worked with the great people at Kevin, who I've worked through my whole career, and we wanted to do everything practical, and Craig was on board too, but it was also a time thing. So what we did is we put fish in the water on fishing poles and jerked them out of the water so that we could get the interaction with the water and the fish. But it was super tedious. So we did a lot of that. So what you're seeing is the great people at Kevin blending all of these frames. It was just like hours of ripping fish out of the water on fishing poles and getting water ripples and stuff combined with CG fish, because in that wide shot, it was like we could have shot for 2 days and not had enough elements to build a wide shot. So it's a combination there of the two. But everything
interesting. Okay.
Almost everything you're seeing outside of that wide shot was practical.
Yeah.
Like we had remote control fish that they would throw in, hit somebody, it would go on the ground, and then a man or woman would be on a remote control flipping them around on the floor.
Yeah.
And whatnot. So yeah, all that was practical.
And what about the people getting hit in the face? Were those all practical moments?
They were, yeah. And the poor guy, there's a spot they called Slap that is a personal fave, where it's a guy who's talking who just keeps getting slapped by the tail of a fish repeatedly while he's trying to make a sentence. And that was all done real. And the guy's poor face was red by the end of it. And we were like, hey, are you okay? And he was like, this is hilarious. Let's just keep going. And we just kept slapping him. And it was just a person with a fish on a pole, slapping him in the face back and forth over and over again. And he was great. He just went with it and tried to talk between, and his glasses flew off his face and all kinds of crazy stuff.
That's so funny. Tell me, what was the process of hiring Craig Gillespie, who's with MJZ? Mm-hmm. What was the process like of choosing him and, you know, that initial triple bid process?
Yeah, and it was, MJZ, I've always been a big fan of them. They always have a great roster there. I had never worked with Craig before, but I always had a lot of respect for him. He was actually just coming off of shooting Cruella, which was a big, big deal to my kids. I'm like, we're working with the director that just shot the movie that you're making me watch 100 times on the Disney Channel. And yeah, so we called him and he just got it immediately. We talked with a bunch of great directors. That's what ideally you always hope to have a hard decision after a pitch process. You know, every once in a while, there's like somebody who just didn't nail it or whatever it may be. But for the most part, like we're going through it right now. I had 4 directors calls today, and it's probably going to be one of the harder decisions I've had to make in my career because they're all just so talented. And Craig was the same way. He came from our first call. He just got it. He said all the right things. His reel speaks for himself. And it just, he was coming off of Cruella. I think he might've been doing the effects or something of Cruella, and the timing just worked out perfectly.
And you said today you had four calls today, right?
Yeah.
And you said, this is going to be the hardest choice you've had. One of the hardest choices.
Yeah.
So what were those calls like? I'm always like curious about what it would be like to be a fly on the wall on your side of things, listening into the conversations and then the conversations you have with your team.
Yeah.
After each of those calls.
You know, it's on several different projects. So it's not, we would never quadruple bid. I'm always, it's the same thing for us. Like I don't love the pitch process and the fact that it's, you're working for free. Sometimes they'll put you up against five or six agencies, which is rough. You know, it's like, it costs, especially for small agencies, mid-level agencies like us, that costs a lot of money to pitch something and a lot of manpower, woman power. So we never, sometimes we'll single bid. If we know something's perfect for somebody, we'll single bid it. And then we talk to the client of why that's so important, but we never quadruple bid. So just so that's on record, like I don't want it to come off as like,
okay, I was going to say that was a little unusual, but
yeah, no, I would never do that. This is on multiple different projects, but yeah, I think these are interesting spots that we have coming out because they're a little bit different than what we've done before. So I kind of went into it with an open mind. And then afterwards, there's a lot of, unfortunately, we're still dealing with COVID on the production front. And we're having to deal with that where they were bidding out Mexico City last week. And then today we can't bid out Mexico City because of all the problems. And now there's a new variant that's flaring up and everybody's super worried naturally about that. And so can we even make it to the shoot again? Like, is that going to be a thing? So a lot of our questions afterwards were around the lame repercussions of being shooting once again in COVID.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's always good. Like I said, we got off these calls and we were like, oh no, it's like they're both amazing. What are we going to do? So that's a good place to be. I kept reminding everybody, like, we're fortunate. This is awesome. Like, two home runs. That's great.
Is it almost always the ideas that the director puts forth on the call or in the treatment that put them into first place? Or are there other qualities that sometimes put someone over the edge?
You hope so. You know, like it's hopefully the things that they bring to the treatment. You know, sometimes I said, if it's a tie, I always go to the real. And I actually encourage when we're pitching against other agencies for business, if you're like, it's between you and one other person, I'm always like, go to the work, because that's what people see. And if we lose because of the work, so be it, you know, but at least make it the work. So I do the same thing for directors. If it's a tie and I can't decide between them, they're both awesome, they both have great ideas, then you go to the reel and you say, which is the better reel? What do I like better? And it always goes to the work for me. So, but we also, you know, we're very respective, like I hope companies are with agencies, which isn't always true, that we would never use an idea from one director and another if we didn't go with that director. And sometimes it can be the difference. There has been ideas that were contributed that were so good. I was like, we have to go with this director because we need this thing that they've added, you know?
You always kind of wonder if you don't, or like I'm talking personally. So like, I always wonder if I put an idea out there and I didn't get the job, I'm like, geez, I hope they didn't use that idea, you know? And I think it is pretty honored throughout the industry, but I'm sure that's there are good times where it does, you know, where maybe an idea from a treatment that didn't get picked, you know, gets used, and I'm sure it can be inadvertent too, but that's nice to know you take it so seriously.
You hope there's some morals left in advertising and some ethics, right?
Yeah.
Like you pray and hope that's still happening.
Yeah. Any additional advice for younger, early career directors generally, maybe in the bidding process or in the process of collaborating with creatives once they've gotten the job?
I would stick with the advice I gave last time, which is don't be afraid of your opinions and stick to your opinions because that's what people are paying for. I think it's a great time to be a young director because with Ranch Rider projects and stuff, the ones that are lower that you can get in and make something great on, I feel like there's just so many of those right now. Like it's, if you can figure out how to make things cheaply but of high quality, you're like, it's a gold rush out there.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes clients are just going directly to directors or directly to production companies or whatever it may be. So
yeah,
I think it's trying to find those opportunities and making the most of them. Because, you know, it's the same thing with pitching for an agency. You can pitch for all the giant projects, you know, or you can pitch on the medium ones and do work along the way and get this great book that then you can go pitch those big ones? Because it's like, you try to hit a home run at every time on some big giant job, or do you hit, if you know, it's like whatever the baseball analogy, I won't pretend to do it right. But yeah, if you get on second base or third base every time, you're the best player in baseball,
right?
You know, so it just more hits and more on base, more opportunities.
And what about last question? Any advice for kind of junior creatives who would love to do something even close to as good as that, the work you're doing now, or that Old Spice work that you did early in your career?
Yeah, I think take risks, be dangerous. I mean, we hire people that are like multidisciplined these days. We have office managers who are doing the back end of fulfillment on these masks. And we have account people that are figuring out how to get shirts made with Velcro and plastic holders. You know, like, I think for us, I can't speak for everybody. I'm sure this isn't true for a lot of agencies, but I'm always looking for something that's like, what can we make together that is unique and cool? And like, if it's not a book, because there's lots of books that are just solid, you know, mm-hmm. they're just good books. And I'm more attracted to the book that's maybe a little bit more up and down, but I'm like, how the crap did you come up with that? Or like, what was the brief and you came up with this crazy stunt? Like, I would never think of that. So if there's something in there that I'm like, I don't know how I'd think of that, I hire them, because I don't need more people that just do the same thing as me. I need more people that are going to make me better. So right. I think trying to that 20% thing, you know, if you, whenever brief you have as a young creative, and everybody's going to do the same thing, because that's the smart thing to do. It makes sense. Like, it's a light bulb. You should talk about this way of selling light bulb. You should try, what's the 20% to the right thing where you're like, no one would ever think about selling a light bulb like this. That's the stuff that, like, I hope most creative directors are looking for. I know it's what we're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Love it. I think that's a great place to end it for now. What's the best way for people to find and follow you?
We have a Callen, this is Callen Instagram. I have a personal Instagram, The Craig Allen, which is not as much about advertising and more jokes around kids, probably. yeah, we have LinkedIn. We're all over the place. We share a lot of stuff on This is Callen and try to keep up with as much as we can. You know, not as much as we'd like to. We're a small agency, so we're trying to make stuff, which sometimes comes at the cost of updating our own channels.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you the best with creating more great work. It's been a pleasure chatting with you again. Thanks for coming on.
Always a pleasure, Zach. Yeah, I had a blast. And anytime.
Thank you again to Craig Allen for joining us on the podcast. Make sure to check out the Callen website, thisiscallen.com, for a look at the spots we chat about and many more. I'm your host, Zach Seckler, and I hope to one day be back to share more interviews with the brightest minds in advertising. Thanks for listening, everyone, and until next time, don't skip those good ads.